Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, the timely and poignant documentary The Commandant's Shadow, which follows Hans-Jürgen Haas, the 87-year-old son of Rudolf Haas, as he faces his father's terrible legacy for the first time. We look at Bratz on Disney Plus, all about the Brat Pack, and Andrew McCarthy as he wrestles with being part of the legendary gang. Plus, we review the much-talked-about horror movie Long Legs, as well as the new space race rom-com Fly Me to the Moon. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com, with the News Talk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all, and I hope you're doing well, despite the horrific weather during the week that felt like November. But anyway, in sad news, we mourn the passing of Shelley Duvall at the still relatively young age of 75, probably known a lot for being an almost muse of Robert Altman in lots of his movies like McCabe and Mrs. Miller and Nashville and in Popeye. She was great in Annie Hall. It was a small part. It was meant to be longer, but they'd had to cut that movie back a lot. But she plays one of Woody Allen's girlfriends who goes to a rock concert with him. She was great in Roxanne, the kind of modern version of Cyrano de Bergerac with Steve Martin. But I suppose all the column inches in the last few days have made reference to her incredible role as the wife of Jack Nicholson in The Shining, the put-upon wife, Wendy Torrance, opposite Jack Nicholson, as Jack Nicholson slowly goes insane. And she was brilliant, conveying that creeping and then full-blooming terror as she witnesses Jack Nicholson become very unhinged. But a great actress. She did stop largely in the noughties for 20 years. She did a small role at the end, had mental health issues that she was quite open about, but a fine actress who passed away earlier this week at the age of 75. So RIP Shelley Duvall. Now in TV this week, I was watching this.
The network has taken a massive risk having me host. They need to feel comfortable with the face they see across the table. They don't want me taking any risks. Trust me.
I don't trust you. You're a fucking liar.
Ava, you have a hiatus coming up for your show, right?
Do
you have any plans?
Are you serious?
She slapped you, she sued you, you said she was toxic, Ava!
I said that stuff when I was mad at her. I would love to set some boundaries for our working relationship. I would like you to stop handing me things that have been inside your mouth. And no more jokes about the size of my hands.
Oh, come on, now those are grandfathered in.
Now that is a clip from season 3 of Hacks. Now, I mentioned Hacks to you last year, and it is all about an aging comedian. And I say that to convey to you that that's very much part of the story. Jean Smart plays Deborah Vance, this lady who's in Vegas and is having some problems. She wants to attract a younger audience, and she's torn between her old kind of comedy gags. She's a comedian, obviously, and a kind of new, let's call it wokeism, that's creeping into comedy. And she befriends, although befriends is overstating it, let's say she employs a young writer to help her, Ava, played brilliantly by Hannah Enbinder. And in the first 2 seasons, they work together. And season 2 ended, it was great. And season 3 landed in May, and I only got around to watching it recently. And Deborah and Ava are reunited because they fell out at the end of season 2, and she has a big possible gig coming up, and she gets Ava back on side, and they start to write and work together and in essence live together. And it's absolutely brilliant. I was talking about it on The Hard Shoulder during the week. I was so surprised that season 3 continues to knock it out of the park, and I think season 3 might be the best of it. This has won Emmys, and rightly so, and it's a great study in kind of comedy and what's funny and what isn't funny anymore, and if funny is always funny. But aside from that, this is hilarious. And that's why I really want to mention it, because there aren't that many hilarious shows around. But Hacks, and particular season 3, which is reasonably new, is absolutely hilarious. And I hope you got a flavor of it there. It's on Amazon for your viewing pleasure. Start at the first one, season 1 and 2. But if you have seen season 1 and 2 and haven't seen season 3, get on it straight away, because I really, really enjoyed this. And in season 3, Deborah has a chance of something big, and it looks at how women have traditionally been treated in comedy. And as I say, a lot about, you know, what jokes you can and can't tell anymore. But aside from all that, it is just goddamn hilarious. A really, really funny watch. So a massive thumbs up for season 3 of Hacks on Amazon. Now you're listening to Screen Time News Talks TV and movie show. That laugh you heard was freelance writer and journalist and film critic, of course, Niamh O'Reilly, who is here to review the week's new cinema releases. Chief among them is a atmospheric elevated horror, whatever the hell that means, called Long Legs. We also have a rom-com about the space race, Fly Me to the Moon. And if there's time, Despicable Me for Niamh. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Your laugh came before you.
It did, yes. I'm thinking of how happy I am this week. There's something for everyone at the box office.
Great.
Which is always good, isn't it?
So listen, I read this thing in the BBC that Long Legs, which is a horror movie, might be kind of like an anti-summer blockbuster. So Tell us what's going on.
I think it might be this. It's fair to say this is probably one of the most anticipated horror films of the year. Horror fans have been dying for this. And part of the reason...
There's a pun in there.
Part of the reason is the marketing has been spot on for this. Unlike some other horror films, Abigail, I'm looking at you, Long Legs does not give away too much in the trailer. So it's really built this anticipation. So this is directed by Oz Perkins, who is the son of the late Anthony Perkins.
Of Psycho?
Yeah.
Wow.
So horror is in his DNA, you might say. It stars Micah Monroe, who was in It Follows, and Nicolas Cage.
Yeah.
And it's a basic setup. It's set in around 1993. And it follows Micah Monroe, who plays a rookie FBI agent called Lee Harker. And she's out sort of on the job, on one of her first jobs. And she shows sort of this amazing intuition, let's just say. Mm. Very, very natural instincts for the job. So she comes to the attention of the agent in charge of a big serial killer case that's going on at the moment. Agent Carter, played by Blair Underwood, mm-hmm. who people will remember from Sex and the City. He brings that same charm to this role. Really, really likable. And he can recognise that she's something special. She's got this really, really spot on intuition.
So it's psychic, possibly.
Well,
let's not
it's
say.
Not, okay. Like, not overtly, but okay. possibly.
Okay.
So it kind of focuses on the two of them, on the case of Long Legs, who is a serial killer who's been active for the last 30 years, baffled the FBI. Mm. The MO is always the same. There is a father who kills his family, typically a wife and at least one daughter, who has a birthday on the 14th of the month, kills them, then takes his own life. On the surface, it looks like murder-suicide, but at every crime scene, there's a letter left behind written in sort of satanic code, for want of a better word, and signed Long Legs.
Uh-huh.
So it's totally baffled the FBI. There's no no forced entry. There's no evidence that anybody else was actually there. But clearly, it's not what it seems. So that's kind of the basic
intriguing setup. And it's not a spoiler to say that Nicolas Cage plays Long Legs.
So, yeah, before I get to Nicolas Cage, just on, I suppose, the look of the film, this is very much influenced by Silence of the Lambs and Seven. And Oz Perkins, like, deliberately cites those as references. Those sort of early 90s detective procedurals that were dark and gritty. Mm. And it really has the look of that here. And Micah Monroe, at point, looks like she's playing dress up as Clarice Starling. Like, they really have that look and feel.
Yeah.
But it is a very different film to Silence of the Lambs. The filmmaker and the cinematographer, I think, use some very deliberate choices in terms of how they frame shots mm-hmm. and the lighting they use mm-hmm. and the music choices to disconcert you at every possible turn. Mm. You can't relax watching this film because you think you're watching one thing, and then they'll use this particular frame or use this particular type of music, and it just jolts you.
Right.
So it all adds to this really uneasy feeling of dread
Okay.
And you, when Nicolas Cage, he is playing the baddie, it's not a spoiler to say that.
Yeah.
But they kind of deliberately hide him for the first 40 minutes. So again, adding to the mystery. And any shots where you do see him at the start, it's from sort of the shoulders down.
Okay.
So you can only see his mannerisms and hear his voice, which is particularly creepy.
Wow.
So it's done to great effect.
And, you know, I describe it as an elevated horror where it's not just jump scares and stuff. There's so much atmosphere in this and techniques to frighten you.
Absolutely. And that's the thing. And that's, for me, what makes a good horror and a horror that gets under your skin.
Yeah.
It's not just something that makes you jump in your seat and you go, oh, ha, yeah. You know, that was kind of fun. This is something I think that will probably stay with viewers when they leave the cinema.
Mm.
And especially Nicolas Cage's performance, he's under an awful lot of prosthetics. You probably wouldn't really recognise him. And the voice, as I mentioned, is particularly creepy. So he's really worked to create, I think, a bad guy that is going to live on long in your memory and long in cinema. I think people will look back and say, God, that was a good baddie. I should also mention Alicia Witt. She plays Lee Harker's mum, and she's sort of, I suppose, a religious recluse, somewhat of a hoarder.
Yeah.
But she's great in this, in a little supporting role.
And it's snowy, isn't it? Like, it's set at winter time.
It is set at winter time, yeah. So again, that all adds to kind of the atmosphere.
And yet it's released in the height of summer. That's why I mentioned the anti-blockbuster kind of vibe.
But it works
really,
really well. And it kind of, it's because of this sort of sense of dread and this sense of unease and sort of, you don't know what's going to happen next. And you can't sort of relax into this at all. And it doesn't rely on jump scares, but it is this sort of unrelenting, dreadful, unsettling atmosphere that just gets you on sort of, I think the best horror films, as I said, they get under your skin or they tap into a primal fear, something more than just, you know, a baddie waiting in the corner.
And this does this in spades.
Does it really, really well. Okay. Now, there's a few little niggles with it. There is a couple of plot holes in this, but like, it's the sort of film, it's not a straight up police procedural. Mm-hmm. There are elements of the supernatural to it. So it is asking the audience to perhaps suspend disbelief at certain points. And I'm not sure whether everyone is going to get with that.
Right.
And there are a couple of plot holes that took me out of the experience. And I hate when that happens because you're in the moment, you're in the atmosphere and you're like, ah, but hang on, what about that?
Okay.
And it takes you out of it. So small niggles.
Right.
But overall, really, really enjoyable. I don't think it is the horror movie of the year. I don't think we've seen that yet.
There's
some really good ones coming up, but it is certainly up there.
I was offered an interview with Michael Munro, and for some bizarre reason, I said no. Silly
next
me.
Time.
Yeah. So tell me this. That sounds pretty good despite the niggle. So what are you going to say stars wise for Long Legs?
Four.
A strong four?
A strong four, as I would say. And also, go and see it in a packed house.
Okay.
I saw this. I was lucky to see it at an evening screening, and it was a packed house. And you really get that sense of everybody going through the same thing as you. So it's not one. Don't wait till it comes to streaming. Go out and see it. It's really, really good.
And for younger listeners, she means, when she says house, she means cinema.
A way of mentioning cinema.
Back in our day. The picture house.
Picture house.
We better take a clip of the aforementioned Long Legs.
There she is. What's your name, little angel? Nice to meet you. Oh, I'll be waiting.
That's a clip from The Creepy Long Legs, which Niamh O'Reilly gave 4 stars to. Now, something completely different, I can't see any way to link the two of them, is a rom-com with Scarlett Johansson and Channing Tatum about the space race.
Yes.
Called, I was going to say intriguingly, but it's not very intriguingly, called Fly Me to the Moon.
And Let Me Play Among the Stars.
If you must.
Yeah, this is totally different. So this is not a film I would probably go and see in the cinema. I have to be upfront and say
fair
that.
Enough.
But it's charming enough.
Okay.
So you're right. It is a rom-com set in the lead up to the Apollo 11 mission. Channing Tatum is playing the mission director. And at this time, NASA is very underfunded. Things are falling apart. It's not great. So he's a bit frustrated with everything that's going on. And then we have Scarlett Johansson, and she plays Kelly Jones, sort of a a Don Draper-style ad exec working in New York. She doesn't have the highest moral scruples, but she is working in a man's world, so yeah. She kind of does what she has to do to get by. And Woody Harrelson visits her one day, and he is playing a sort of a fedora-wearing shadowy government agent called Mo Burkus, and he says to her, "You're great at your job, but I want to hire you. We need you to sell the space race to the American people."
Okay.
Because at that point, people were turned off by it. It was taking too long.
Yeah. And it's sorry to interrupt you, but it is based on the actual space race, like Buzz Aldrin, Armstrong.
Oh, yeah, it is. Yeah. Like there's a voiceover at the beginning of Woody Harrelson saying, you know, this is based on a true story, mainly. You know, so it's kind of tongue-in-cheek. Yeah. But it's definitely, I mean, Buzz Aldrin and all the lads are there. So she takes the job. She's intrigued. She heads off to Florida. And when she arrives the first evening, she's a meet-cute with Channing Tatum, mm-hmm. in a very lovely Americana-style diner. Neither knows who the other one is until the next day when she arrives at NASA and it's like, oh, we're going to be working together. And they immediately don't like one another because she's there to change everything and sell the space race and he's kind of old school and wants to focus on the mission. So it's kind of an enemies to lovers trope.
Okay.
And if that's all the film was, it would probably have worked. But I think they're trying to throw everything at this because it is part rom-com, it is part historical drama, it's part farce. There's this long-running gag with a black cat that keeps going past Channing Tatum. That it's funny at the start, but at the end you're just like, oh my gosh, someone just catch this cat. And then it goes weirdly into this conspiracy drama element. So,
as in, did we land on the moon at all? Kind of.
Basically, yeah. So Woody Harrelson, halfway sort of through the film, says to Scarlett Johansson's character, "You're doing a great job, but what we want you to do is film a fake moon landing in case we don't make it happen and we don't want America to be embarrassed." And it's a funny riff on the long-standing conspiracy theory that the moon landing was faked and that Kubrick, you know, filmed it and all that sort of stuff. So I can see what they were trying to do, but it just doesn't work.
Okay.
They're just trying to put too much into this. And tonally, you don't know what this film is actually trying to do.
And what's the chemistry like between the wonderful Scarlett Johansson, the slightly less wonderful?
You know, steady. He's pretty good. It's good. And they have a fair amount of chemistry.
Okay.
And I think they're both actors who perhaps don't do as much comedy as they could. I think.
Do you not find Tatum a bit wooden a lot of the time? No.
I'm sure you could definitely level that criticism at him, but I think sometimes he does it sort of like deliberately.
Yeah.
He's leaning into the fact that, like, physique-wise, he could easily just have gone down the action route.
Yeah.
But he hasn't actually done that. He's done a lot of kind of comedy.
Yeah, I suppose
stuff,
maybe I'm being,
you know,
a bit unfair.
And I think he leans into that. Like, I don't know if you remember in Bullet Train, he had a brilliant cameo.
Yeah, that's
that.
Right, yeah. It was
really
hilarious.
Funny.
Actually, yeah.
Yeah, so I think he does a deadpan. I think that's kind of how he delivers it.
Mm.
So they have a fair amount of chemistry, but it just overall, it just didn't work. None of these elements sort of tied together into a cohesive kind of film, and it's far too long. I was looking at my watch.
How long is it?
It's 2 hours, 10 minutes,
okay.
But it feels every single minute of it. Unfortunately, they could have shaved half an hour off this and it would have been much tighter and much more together. Definitely.
So what are you going to say stars-wise for Fly Me to the Moon?
Yeah, it's beautiful to look at, I have to say. Nice 60s soundtrack, lovely costuming and everything. And they do evoke, there's a montage at the beginning that sort of gives you a recap of the space race. And it does bring home to you like how important this was and how dangerous it was. Like, people died, you know, in this. So I'm going to say 2.5.
Okay, that sounds about fair. I haven't seen it, but it sounds about right. You had a busy week.
I did.
Because you also went to see Despicable Me 4 with your
sins.
Children.
I did.
And we don't have much time
that's
left,
right.
but in a minute or so, you know, they're fine movies by me.
Yeah.
Is this a fine movie or do they need to stop?
It's very much true to form.
Yeah.
There's an awful lot going on in this.
Yeah.
The minions are sort of off on their own little side mission. Gru comes face to face with an old nemesis voiced by Will Ferrell, who's always brilliant. They have a bit of a face off. Gru now has a baby.
Played by Steve Carell.
Yes, Gru, obviously, sorry, is played by Steve Carell. Yeah, and he's still brilliant at it. You know, he's so funny. Kristen Wiig plays his wife, Lucy. They have a baby now, as well as the three little girls that they adopted. So life is good, but they have to go into witness protection because of this new threat, Maxime, voiced by Will Ferrell. So that brings up all sorts of kind of headaches, them trying to fit into a new town and new identities and stuff like that. The minions are farmed off somewhere else for the time being. Some of them are turned into mega minions with superpowers. None of it makes sense. The house that they move into, the little girl wants to be a villain of her own. So she kind of blackmails Gru and they go off on a little side mission. There's a hell of a lot going on here, but it's funny. The minions will never not be funny.
Yeah.
There's some really good gags here. It doesn't all tie together, but I don't think it really matters.
Did your children enjoy it?
They enjoyed it. My 7-year-old in particular laughed out loud so many times. And that's always what you want. And I had a giggle too.
Yeah.
You know, it is what it is. And it's good. It's not never going to be Pixar or have any lofty, you know, ambitions or saying more than it actually is. It is what it is. It's slapstick.
So stars wise for Despicable Me 4?
I would say 3 stars.
Excellent. Well, listen, a pretty good week for the cinema all around. So all 3 of those movies are in the cinema. They were given respectively 4, 2.5 and 3 by the giggling and laughing Niamh O'Reilly. Niamh.
Thank you.
After the break, a seriously powerful documentary called The Commandant's Shadow. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now releasing in cinemas this week is another movie called The Commandant's Shadow. It's very different to what we were talking about before the break because it follows Hans-Jürgen Haas, the 87-year-old son of Rudolf Haas. Rudolf Haas being the man who in essence carried out the savagery at Auschwitz. And this is, I suppose, in a way, the documentary version of the Oscar-winning movie, The Zone of Interest, which was all about the life of Haas and his family, albeit fictionalized, as they lived outside Auschwitz. This documentary tells the story of those real people. It follows the son of Rudolf Haas, Hans-Jürgen Haas, and it watches him struggle, deny, and eventually come to terms with what his father actually did. It's a chilling documentary at times. In tandem with that, we also have the character of Anita Lasker-Wolfitsch, who was a cellist in Auschwitz as a child. She was a German Jew, and because she could play the cello, she was spared execution and horrifically had to play the cello as part of these musical accompaniments as people literally marched to their death. This lady Anita, we see her in her 90s and also her daughter Maya. And Anita has, I suppose, learned to cope with life by kind of just getting on about it. Her own daughter Maya struggles with how the Holocaust and her surviving of it affected her life and her upbringing. This is a documentary, I suppose, that's looking at the impact of these horrible events on the children of the people involved in these and the children's children, as well as Hans Haas, the son of Rudolf Haas. We also meet his son, Kai Haas, and we also meet Maya, the daughter of Anita, who survived in Auschwitz. And it's a spoiler of sorts. We have Anita and Hans meeting. So you have the survivor of Auschwitz meeting the son of the man who carried out the horrors at Auschwitz. As I say, this is all contained in a remarkable documentary which is on release in select cinemas from this Friday called The Commandant's Shadow. It was directed by a lady called Daniela Volker, who I spoke to earlier in the week. Daniela, I'm just wondering, you know, Hans says near the start of the movie, I had a wonderful childhood near Auschwitz or at Auschwitz. And I heard a cameraman said to you in the early days of filming, you know, this guy kind of doesn't know what's going on. Did you have like worries at the start that Hans might not be able to go on the journey that I guess as an audience and as a filmmaker, we all wanted him to go on?
It's an interesting question. So actually, when I first met Hans-Jürgen on our very, very first day, I filmed an interview in which, to summarize, he hadn't seen anything, couldn't remember anything. And as far as he knew, everything at Auschwitz had been great. I mean, he had obviously read history books afterwards, but he sort of thought his father was basically the director of a prison, and he was stamping documents, riding horses, and not individually involved with the kind of minutiae of mass extermination down the road. So at that point, my German cameraman at the time said to me, "You're wasting your time and money. Let's go home." But I had brought with me the autobiography Rudolf Hess, his father, had written as he was awaiting trial in Poland. And it is an extraordinary document. Rudolf Höss was in the unique position of being both prime witness and perpetrator. He wrote everything down. He didn't mince his words. You know, it is an extraordinary account of imagining, planning and carrying out mass murder. And as we filmed Hans-Jürgen reading the autobiography for the first time, and this is well before we went to Auschwitz with him, there I could tell, actually, there is a story here, because, you know, his face changed and he was utterly horrified being confronted for the first time, black on white, in his father's own words, with the extent of his culpability. So, you know, it was at that point, 5 days into our acquaintance in person, I suppose, that I realized that actually there is a story here to tell. And it also hasn't been told before, which is almost extraordinary. You know, I mean, it's documentary gold to come across someone in his 80s who has spent a lifetime avoiding dealing with something so massive, which has overshadowed to some extent a lot of his life.
Yeah, and your it is documentary gold, and your use of Huss's autobiography is brilliantly used. It really is. And I presume a lot of people say this to you as well, but I was so taken with the other principal character, Anita, because, you know, and people can watch, and we don't have to go into her full story here, but she was a cellist, in essence, a young cellist who managed to avoid extermination because she played the cello. I mean, I'm getting the hairs on the back of my neck are standing up just even saying those words. But what I was so taken about with her was she is so matter of fact about this horror she's lived through. And, you know, we need to just get on with things is kind of her take on things. And yet, and I hope it's not a spoiler, but it's a very important part of the movie, she welcomes Hans into her home near the end of the movie. And it's you talk about documentary gold. That is documentary gold. So I guess this very long way of me asking you, I can't believe you found her and she was willing to talk. I mean, she's nearly more gold than Hans is. But you tell me.
So I was put in touch in the early days of the COVID lockdown, actually, when we were all kind of stuck at home. A friend contacted me because she was representing Maya Laskavalfish, who is Anita's daughter. And she was interested in sharing her experiences of transgenerational trauma as daughter of a Holocaust survivor. So I met Maya on Zoom. Then I eventually met Anita in person. And it was very interesting also to tell that story, because I think survivors are often kind of portrayed, or it's easy to portray them as just survivors. And of course, that was a really important thing they did. They survived the death machine that the Nazis had created. But, you know, after the war, Anita had an incredibly successful career as a cellist. She had a family. And it was interesting to me how mother and daughter were so different, because, as you say, Anita is very matter of fact. It's, you know, she says trauma, you know, what trauma, get on with it. You know, she's basically doesn't fret and just gets on with things. And to her daughter, the past was still very much alive, you know, and it overshadowed part of her life. So it was something kind of outstanding that she needed to deal with, in the same way, actually, I found Hans-Jürgen, without knowing it, also needed to actually confront his past. So, you know, the mother-daughter dynamic was very interesting. And of course, Anita was 18. She was a young adult when she was at Auschwitz. I mean, there aren't many direct witnesses who have that amount of, you know, knowledge and memory, you know, because she wasn't a child. Mm. She was 18. So actually, I found it was just extraordinary. The meeting between Anita, Hans-Jürgen and their children was, I think, the most extraordinary get-together I ever filmed.
I can imagine. It must. I said it's spine tingling even recounting it to you. But to be in the room must be, you know. One thing I was really struck by about the film was, like, there are such incredible moments of, like, where Hans is back at the gallows where his father Rudolf Hess was hanged, when he's in Auschwitz walking around the death camp. But it seems to me that your film, beyond any question, like, should be shown in schools to show people that Holocaust denial simply cannot exist on any level. Like, have you had that reaction from other people who've seen the movie, that, like, how can you possibly deny the Holocaust? Like, your film is a clarion call that it could never be denied. But that's my take of it.
Yeah, I mean, the commandant's words themselves are ultimate proof. His son said on film, it's incredible. On camera, Hans-Jürgen was reading his father's autobiography and then said, I couldn't really believe it, but these are my father's words, so it must be true. Because a lot of what he talks about really is quite unbelievable. I mean, it's not just the method, it's the scale and the sheer amount of people. And, you know, Anita, in an interview from 1945, she talks about the arrivals at the ramp and the selection, right, left, right, left. And, you know, if you go right, you live, and left, she says, is the chimney. So, I mean, all these things are just so extraordinary. We were very fortunate in our film to have both the words of the perpetrator. It's almost like a true crime story in parts, where the criminal wrote his deathbed confession. Mm-hmm. But we also have the testimony of one woman who survived, and she also saw a lot of what happened. And she talked about it in an interview in 1945, which we showed twice. We played twice in the film. And I think these are put together very powerful tools. In terms of education, we are actually planning to run an educational program alongside the film, so its legacy lives on, because it is important that children know about this part of our past. And in Germany, I heard that there were entire schools that sent children aged between 15 and 17 to the cinema to watch the film. So that was very encouraging as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, I think they should be showing it in Irish schools. It's a remarkable piece of work, and I watch a lot of movies, but this one has lasted long with me since I saw it a few days ago. Lovely to talk to you, Daniela.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Daniela Volker there, talking to me about the powerful documentary that is The Commandant's Shadow, which is in cinemas, select cinemas, from this Friday, the 12th of July. And as was very evident, I think, from what I was saying, it is a powerful, powerful watch. Up next, something very different. We look at the Brat Pack. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talks TV and movie show. Now, Landed on Disney Plus as of last Friday is a fantastic documentary, at least I think it is, called Brats, directed by the great Andrew McCarthy, all about his time in what became known as the Brat Pack. Now, here's the thing. I rang up Disney last week wondering could I talk to Andrew McCarthy, and was devastated to realise that 3 weeks prior they had sent me an invite to interview him, and I just missed it. And I'm absolutely raging about it. So I needed to bring out the big guns to review it. And I'm delighted to be joined by showbiz editor of the Irish Sun, Ken Sweeney. It's first time on Screen Time. But Ken, thank you for coming in. The reason why I want to ask you is because we're of a similar vintage, and you would have been reminiscent, or you would certainly know who the Brat Pack were back in the day. So what's going on in Bratz?
Well, you know, this all goes back to a piece that David Blum, a journalist, David Blum, who worked for The New Yorker, he was given an assignment to do a couple of days with Emilio Estevez. Mm. But he didn't do that. He actually wrote a cover story. He was hanging around with Emilio for a couple of days. And he ended up doing a cover story about all the young actors that Emilio was hanging out with, and a few he didn't even meet. And he wrote this up, and he put this title on the article, The Brat Pack. And this was at, let's say, 1985, and these new actors were part of a new breed of young actors. We're talking about Rob Lowe, Monty Ringwald, Demi Moore, Judd Nelson, loads of people. Basically, not everybody was happy that they'd been described as the Brat Pack. In fact, this is what this documentary is all about. Some of these actors feel that this did them irreparable harm, that they were serious young actors. And the fact that they were put into this, you know, title, the Brat Pack, that stopped, I quote, Martin Scorsese ringing them up for a film. Now, some of them did really well, you know, but this is interesting for me, not only because of these actors, but because of the journalist. The whole focus of this show comes to Andrew McCarthy actually confronting David Blum about this article.
Yeah. And so McCarthy is the director and the guy who's most aggrieved or has been most troubled all his career, even though he had a lot of success as an actor, but he was 22 when the Brat Pack started. So he decides he's going to contact fellow Brat Packers. And I think it's fair to say with very interesting results. So he first meets Amelia.
Yeah. Yeah, now it's there's a lot of that stuff, him on the phone. Do you really need that stuff? I suppose you do. But, I mean, some of them, this thing really matters to them. You know, this article, they feel, really did them harm. Mm. Not all of them. I mean, you know, Demi Moore is in it and is brilliant. And she's kind of saying, well, you know, she's saying, look, whatever insecurity you had, maybe this article, you know, touched on it. And then maybe, you know, you felt slighted by it. And maybe your career was affected by that. Just on a totally different subject. I do a lot of work with bands. I talk to a lot of bands from 1979, 1980, and they send me their biographies of these bands, and they always tell me that they were due to play on Top of the Pops in 1979, but there was a strike in the BBC and their appearance didn't happen and their career was badly affected by that. Only if they got on Top of the Pops in 1980, the nation would have seen them, 20 million people on Top of the Pops. And this is very similar to this Brat Pack thing. And it's weird because some of them feel they've been damaged by it, but listen, at the end of the day, no one died. No one ended up living on the street. I mean, Rob Lowe, you know, Emilio Estevez, they had all these amazing careers. And I suppose, you listen, the maddest thing about this thing is not only the careers, not only the thing that it's touching on, myself and my wife and my son were looking at it and we're thinking, God, it's really interesting to see how these people, how they appear, because everyone's looking at Demi Moore to think, how have these people coped with aging? Have they had fillers? Have they had this, that and the other? And it's really nice to see some of these people, because these films were very iconic, you know, and it's great to see those actors again, because some of them, you know, you don't see on the screen anymore. You just see what they look like again.
Yeah. Now, when we go through them, Emilio, like, he struck me as certainly someone who didn't enjoy the Brat Pack experience and was trying to get away from it. Demi was a lot more, you know, we did well out of it, as you said. But McCarthy, whose brainchild it is, seems the most troubled by it. And you felt, I don't know what you felt, but I felt this was kind of like some cinematic therapy session he was engaging in for us to see.
It was. It was. And, you know, you could see that, especially in the end when he meets the journalist responsible, David Blum. Yeah. You can see him biting back. And I must admit, I was quite impressed by Andrew that he didn't lose it with the journalist, because the journalist, you know, David Blum, you know, he didn't seem that bothered about
what he'd done.
He felt this was like collateral damage. I am an entertainment journalist myself, and there's two different types of entertainment journalists. There's the ones who know they're a journalist and are happy doing it, and then the others that seem to think they're some kind of celebrity and pop up on cooking shows and stuff.
And David Blum, which one are you?
Well, I'm an ex-musician. I was delighted to get into journalism, and I'm not a star or a celebrity. I haven't done any cooking shows. I'm unlikely to appear in the next series of Dancing with the Stars or anything like that. But I do feel that David Blum, I mean, I've read a couple of interviews with him lately, and you know, he doesn't see anything wrong with it. He sees it as collateral damage. He probably just doesn't know, probably the effect it's had on these people, and these actors have been thinking about it. At the same time, there were things that I read the original article that he wrote in 1985, and the stuff in it I wouldn't have done. Like, he talks about Emilio, I think it was, or one of them, trying to get free cinema tickets and this kind of stuff. And I don't think it needed. I mean, I think, you know, what I know about, I was in indie bands, and my band would get reviewed, and this was before the internet, and they'd refer to my band, Brian, as Winsome. The single was Winsome. And me and the other guy in the band, Niall Austin, we used to drive around trying to find out, what does Winsome mean? What does Winsome mean? Because we put so much, we had so much interest into what they were saying, we didn't quite understand it. It means winning ways, by the way.
Yes.
What I'm saying, what I'm trying to say to you is, when you're an artist or musician, a filmmaker, an actor, you put an awful lot of thought into what a journalist has said about you. And 15 years later, when I ended up a journalist in the Herald or the Indo or whatever, I realised the journalists throw things down all the time. They don't even think about it. They just do it because they're being funny. But yet, it has an impact on people's lives, and people think about it too much. And this documentary is full of people
who've thought about it a bit too much, a bit like Andrew McCarthy.
Yeah. What did you think of Andrew McCarthy as a host, as the guy guiding it through? Do you think he was too navel-gazing? I don't want to put words in your mouth. Or did you think he seemed like a decent skin?
I thought he was an interesting guy. And he did that. I don't know what age he is, but he did that thing that, you know, people, you know, a touch 50 do. He was carrying around his glasses all the time. It was a bit kind of, I felt a bit sorry for him when he's ringing up these, you know, other brat packers trying to get them to take part. And obviously, you know, listen, there's so many questions in this. If the brat pack term hadn't been invented, would Andrew McCarthy be fronting a Disney documentary going around? So listen, none of these people have starved since. They all became movie stars. My God, can you imagine the actors? And he does interview a few of them who were on the periphery of this scene, who weren't involved, were quite envious of this brat pack type thing. But again and again through this documentary, you hear this allegation that by calling them the brat pack, which is a joke on the rat pack, this brat pack, you know, they don't kind of deserve it. They're young, they're flashy with money. Mm. He makes the journalist David Blum makes the point that, you know, Rob Lowe came out of some amateur production. People like De Niro and Brando had trained for years, Stanislavski and all this sort of stuff, and then they'd gone to Hollywood. But a lot of these young brat packers, you know, had gone straight out, you know, gone straight into huge movies and become big stars. And of course, we go back to this original article where the journalist is sitting at the table with Emilio Estevez and, you know, in some diner, and all these pretty girls are coming up and he's getting the least amount of attention. So that aspect that maybe the journalist was a bit, you know.
But he is like the highlight of it, because I found it very entertaining, but the highlight of it is there, I was going to say confrontation, but when McCarthy meets Blum, he is kind of like, it was my job, I had to write a think piece, I made it a bit bigger, no biggie, you know. And you felt that McCarthy maybe kind of got it and said okay,
you know, that's one of the scenes I quite like. You can see the expression on Andrew McCarthy's face, he's holding back all the time. This guy is, you know, what he asks him, would he do it again? Would he describe this bunch of young actors as the brat pack and perhaps, you know, impact some of their careers? And he says without a doubt he'd kind of do it again. Documentaries have to have an ending, so it's all building up to this kind of meeting, and then you're hearing it from both sides. But at the end of it, he's hugging the guy. I mean, Andrew McCarthy is hugging the guy at the end. So you kind of think, wow, where's that all going? So it's I suppose, listen, let's remember that back at this time in 1985, when these films were coming out, no one had made, you know, young people hadn't really featured at the focus of films. This was all about all these The Breakfast Club and all these films and these characters, and young people really identified with them. And there's a lot of authors in it, brilliant authors in this documentary, who are talking about, you know, the impact of the Brat Pack. And listen, if you didn't have the Brat Pack, you probably wouldn't have had Glee, you probably wouldn't have had Friends. I mean, the list is endless. They really kind of broke ground. And, you know, I just think it's a wonderful, what a wonderful time to be associated with. I'm just thinking, like, you know, listen, if you were 22 and you were involved in the D-Day landings and you were landing on the beaches of Normandy, you've got German machine guns mowing down your friends and taking out lumps of body parts, then you've got something to worry about. If you were part of that Brat Pack and you were making these amazing films and you were 22 and all these girls wanted to meet you, is there really all that much to complain about?
No, absolutely not. And as you say, John Hughes, the director involved in a lot of these, they kind of not invented the teenager, but they put that young person front and centre. And as you say, we wouldn't have a Glee. One of the criticisms I have, but it's a tiny thing, is I would like to have seen more clips of the movies. Maybe there was copyright issues, but I would have liked to have seen a bit more of The Breakfast Club, Pretty in Pink, Say Anything, all those kind of ones. You know,
I think the clips that I do like in it are the ones where, you know, subsequently after the article, you know, these actors are being interviewed about the article and they're absolutely outraged. At one stage, a journalist from I think it was Time magazine, or you know he apologises for his whole profession over this article, which, you know, he feels is terrible, and you can see how pissed off they are. And they interview some of the agents who were working with them, and they're sympathetic to some of the actors who felt the article was doing harm. But I mean, really, it's just one article. You can kind of blame all sorts of things, and you know, you just have to just get on with life. And certainly, some of these actors have never been, you know, off the screen since.
No, absolutely.
So it didn't stop some of them. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, it's like bands. It's like there are bands who were out in the 80s that are still selling lots of records and still quite valid, and then there are bands that just kind of disappeared, and they're, you know, they're popping up on these tours with backing tapes and stuff like that. It's a total game of chance. Yeah. It's interesting. I think any documentary that, you know, goes back over people, you know, the lessons in life, you know, what they've learned, I think is really interesting. And these films are really popular, and you know, these people, you know, are remain interesting. And it was nice to see them all again.
Yeah,
you know, it's
So on that, this is your first time on the show. We always ask people when they're reviewing, so for a star rating, so what would you say out of five for Bratz?
I'd say I'd give it maybe 4 out of 5.
Okay.
And there's actually, madly enough, if you go back to the original Brat Pack article, there's a reference to Harry Dean Stanton, who's in my favourite film, Paris, Texas. He was apparently the hero to the Brat Pack. They loved hanging out with him. So listen, if these people liked Paris, Texas and liked Harry Dean Stanton, they can't have been all bad.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. And finally then, you just mentioned you watch it with your son and wife. Your son is considerably younger than you and I, and probably wasn't born when this started, the whole Brat Pack thing. What did he make of it?
He loved it. He loved it. He loved the fact that I think he could, being a younger person, you know, he's 18, he could identify with the young actors and how they felt about being thrown into this term, you know, which he felt for the young stars and felt outrage, and he felt that the journalist, you know, should have maybe, you know, taken more responsibility for what he'd done. So, you know, it was interesting to see it from both sides. And, you know, my wife, Dee, was just talking about the appearance of people and how fantastic, fantastic they all look and who's had work done, and she enjoyed the films. I'd have to say, I probably wasn't wild into the Rat Pack. In 1985, I was in the SFX watching REM. So there was a whole different sort of America I was interested in. But, you know, these films are iconic and they're still out there. And there was this whole moment of video as well that's examined in it, where people could go home and watch these films on video cassettes, and you know, they really, you know, identified with the characters, and there wasn't actually that's the point is made in the film. There weren't a lot of, you know, black people in these films, which is very strange.
Yeah, it is.
You know, they had a black writer on, and he said that, you know, at that stage in America, you had to kind of learn to identify with white characters and stuff. So I suppose that's disappointing about it. But the it's a mood, it's a time in people's place. I'm sure in Ireland people remember MTV USA.
Yes, indeed we do. Let's not get into that right now. Well, Bratz is on Disney Plus. I think it's great. Ken Sweeney does as well, because he gave it 4 stars, and I think his son probably would go along with that as well. Ken, showbiz editor with the Irish Sun, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thanks a lot, John.
If you were coming of age in the 1980s, the Brat Pack was near the center of your cultural awareness. But for those of us experiencing it from the inside, the Brat Pack was something very different. On June 10th, 1985, New York Magazine published Hollywood's Brat Pack. I just remember seeing that cover and thinking, oh. From then on, my career and the career of everyone who was involved was branded as the Brat Pack.
I'm really sorry that article had to come out.
I've never talked to anybody about what that was like. So I thought it might be interesting to try and contact everyone who was in the Brat Pack.
Hey, Emilio Estevez. This is Andrew McCarthy calling you.
Hey, Allie.
Hey, Demi.
Hey, Molly. Let's call Rob.
Hello. Judd?
From Bratz, which is now streaming on Disney Plus, and it's a great watch and brings you right back to that era of the Brat Pack and some of those movies like Pretty in Pink and St. Elmo's Fire and The Breakfast Club. As I said, I would like to have seen more clips from the movies, but it's still a great documentary. And Andrew McCarthy seems like a really nice guy, if a little navel-gazy, but you know, we're all guilty of that, present company included. That is it for this week. Next week on the show, I'm talking to the makers of a fantastic new Netflix documentary called Skywalkers, all about people who climb up incredibly high on very tall buildings. Mad stuff altogether. And we haven't done the favourite movie slot in a while, but it's back with a bang next week, because I'm going to be talking to the one and only Colm Tobin about his favourite movie, and hopefully a bit about making movies out of your books. So that's all to come next week. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch with me at any stage, you can email me screentime@newstalk.com, or I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Enjoy the remainder of your weekend. Have a safe week ahead, and I'll talk to you all next week.